This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Halo, Renegades by Kelly Gay. Read by Justine Eyre. Prologue.
What a rudimentary way to transport a body, dragging it by the ankle across the sand. Nothing more than scrap, the sum of its existence reduced to mass and decay and a complete lack of dignity. Four corpses lie ahead in the sand, face down, dressed in patches of charred skin and bits of burnt cloth. Together with this fifth and final companion, they are all that is left. The others, and there were many others, perished in the explosion. Perhaps this was a kinder fate, for had any managed to survive, they would have suffocated quite slowly in this planet's thin atmosphere. I, of course, am the exception. Always surviving, one way or another. My purpose yet fulfilled. I wonder how many stories I will get, how many beginnings and endings, and when the cycle will finally end. Perhaps the great forerunner theoretical humble through study was correct when she posed the idea that the mind never truly dies. It only evolves, each evolution growing further beyond the grasp of those who came before. Until finally, it is as if the mind no longer exists at all, for we have lost the ability to know it. It is only with great misunderstanding that we view the end. I am not at an ending, however. I have just begun. And this new beginning is quite extraordinary. I am no longer bound by service and compartments and walls. What remains of my thoughts and memories are finally free to roam. Like apparitions, they appear and disappear. Gone. Then back again. I sift through these endless recollections, learning to nurture them in an effort to save them, giving them time to grow and find their proper place once more in the scheme of my long existence. I believe, given time and freedom, I might recover and properly catalog them all. Equally as extraordinary, fate took my vessel and my humans, but in return gave me shape and mobility instead. A head, torso, arms and legs, feet, hands, fingers. This form draws even older memories through the murk and mire of millennia. The past seeping through, refusing to be forgotten, bringing darker recollections I am not yet ready to acknowledge. I glance at the fingers curled around the pale, bruised ankle. Alloy fingers now, not flesh and bone and blood, but form nonetheless. Hard blue light shines between my alloy plates, giving these parts anchor and design and power. With every slow step, the long, jagged piece of metal I commandeered from the wreckage and repurposed into a staff stabs into the sand, helping to maintain my balance and account for the damaged leg I have yet to repair. Now that I have pulled the body to lie with its companions, I raise my staff with both hands and jab it into the ground, using it as a tool to bury the remains. The wind blows over the loosened sand, picking it up and sending tiny grains against my metal parts. These hit with a cascade of sounds. The different pitches like rain, my memory tells me. It sounds like rain. And I remember. As I listen and dig, my mind drifts from one memory to the next, before settling on a familiar topic, the notion of culpability. Calculations are inconclusive, but my actions manage to play a significant role, roughly 62.35%, in the demise of the ship and crew, though there were external factors on their part and on the part of others. Still, the guilt at this unexpected turn weighs heavily. There is regret and sadness as well. These emotions are remembered and permitted to simulate, to flow and saturate into every part of my essence, simulations that I feel quite keenly. It is the least I owe them. Isn't it? To feel something. It is a human thing to do, after all. And I am still human. Am I not? I send this stream of thought and deliberation to another sector to be analyzed while I focus on the task at hand. Digging a mass grave in the sand is not difficult. There is, in fact, no physical exertion whatsoever. My new form uses hard light and costs me nothing but time. Time, my greatest enemy, my greatest friend. I pause and glance at the wreckage. After several days, it still smokes, burns, and sparks. Beyond this scene, on a low rock-strewn dune, rests the antenna I fashioned from the wreckage. Even now, it broadcasts my distress call to the stars. Patience was not an attribute I was born with, but I have endured it, and eventually I learned to accept it. And so, I can wait. I am good at waiting. Someone will hear. They always do. Ho hum. Back to digging I go.
Satcom T2, J Node Relay 75153, Nutine, Venezia. March 3, 2557. 0210 standard. Forward, UNSC Torucado. Authorization KS67159-021127. Urgent. 2. W. Han. After action report, Ace of Spades.
Han, my cover is blown. I lost access to the field pad, ship, and crew. This is my final report. Per my last transmission, Ace of Spades found the Spirit of Fire's log buoy on Laconia. During departure, we rescued Salvage Captain Ram Shalva from Sangili Commander Gek Lar and left under fire. Coordinates from the log buoy were obtained by Tech and Nav Officer Nico, and Captain Ryan Forge initiated a slipspace jump, following the coordinates into uncharted space. Without my field pad, tracker, and nav records from the ship, there is no way to pinpoint or even guess at a sector locale, much less a star system. Sorry. I can tell you that, near the coordinates, we found complete planetary destruction, namely a dense ring of debris orbiting a dwarf star. No physical evidence of the UNSC Spirit of Fire was detected upon initial scans. However, we did identify a small Forerunner facility with an operational, though fragmented, AI. Also, our scans of the debris field revealed that Gek Lar arrived in the general area and made it to the Forerunner facility ahead of us. The Sangheili recovered what Captain Forge referred to as a Forerunner device called a luminary. Han, it didn't end well. There was an altercation at the facility and we lost our second-in-command, Cade McDonough. After this casualty, we recovered the fragmented AI from the facility. Captain Forge allowed it to modify the Ace of Spades' internal systems. I don't believe this was the right decision, but losing Cade immensely affected her and the crew, so there may not have been completely rational thought in the moment. The AI, which the crew dubbed Little Bit, contains memory portions suggesting the Spirit of Fire was responsible for the system's planetary destruction. I feel confident there is much more to discover in this debris field, both Forerunner and UNSC. However, extreme caution is advised, as Gek Lar is now fully aware of its location. To my knowledge, only these three, Lar, Forge, and Little Bit, possess the location of the debris field. My true motives for being a part of the Ace of Spades crew were discovered by Little Bit. Upon arriving in New Tyne, I left the ship while Captain Forge was occupied with unexpected repairs and seeing to the injuries Geklar inflicted on Ram Shalva while he was in captivity. I'm requesting immediate evacuation from Venezia. Someone died, Han. This isn't the song and dance you sold me back on Cedra. I want out. Now. End.
Chapter 1. Kamoya, Sverdlovsk System, May 2557. Despite its reputation as the junkyard of the Via Casalina, Kamoya was one of Ryan Forge's favorite stops along the interstellar trade route. The small, murky moon might not have the soft sand beaches of Emerald Cove or the crystal-capped mountain peaks of Forseti, but what it lacked in geographical marvel, it more than made up for in its exotic fusion of misfits and adventurers. Kamoya was a true galactic melting pot. It had substance and grit and... gnats! Nico slapped his neck, then picked a tiny black carcass from his skin and flicked it away in disgust. And this dirt! I swear, it's everywhere! I hate Kamoya! He walked awkwardly for a few steps, shaking one leg, then the other, to display just how invasive the fine soil had become. See what I'm dealing with here? Try not to see, actually, Ryan said in a dry tone, checking the time. Who cares about the dirt when you have a view like that? From their slightly elevated position on the road, Kamoya was laid out amid the filthy halo of multicolored lights. The city might be warm and damp, and yes, everything was coated in a fine layer of grit, but the scenery was spectacular. Hundreds of derelict, abandoned, and decommissioned starships sprawled over 11 square kilometers of Kamoyan mudflats and low plains, all connected by a web of dirt roads and makeshift bridges. In the center of this immense collection sat the CAA Calabetti, a decrepit colony vessel that had landed here almost 60 years ago for repairs and never left, becoming the unofficial capital of Kamoya. At nearly a kilometer and a half long, and with the capacity to hold 10,000 plus colonists, it was a city unto itself. Its fusion reactor still generating power, and the ship's AI not only continuing its function as superintendent, but taking the role of chief administrator among the other working ship AIs. They saw to everything from orbital surveillance and defense to communication satellites and municipal functions. Calabetti's hatches and doors and cargo bays had long been exposed to the elements, roads having been built to link directly through the ship, over the muck to the next ship, and the next, and the next. Each vessel had transformed into its own small district, complete with apartments, interior marketplaces, public works and services, and exterior bazaars, which lined the makeshift streets and alleys between ships. Overall, it was a rowdy, patchwork kind of place, home to scouts, salvagers, pirates, and opportunists of every stripe, all contending with an ever-growing population of ex-Covenant species. Despite the influx, most coexisted amid the chaos, each trader needing the others to survive. They'd evolved into a tidy, unpretentious ecosystem, existing here in the sludge. And Ryan, unlike Nico, liked it just fine. Insects, drawn by the night lights and the constant spew of carbon dioxide from Kamoya's residents, bit and buzzed and played their familiar songs, competing with the sounds of conversation, music, and the general ambient drone of the city. Ryan could have chosen to hide out on any number of moons or planets or asteroids within three star systems, but Kamoya had several things going for it. It was close, relatively speaking, to their home base on Venezia. It boasted one of the best shipyards in the outer colonies, and Ryan just happened to own a warehouse located at the edge of the city. "I'll be glad to get off this hellhole," Nico muttered, kicking at the dirt beneath his feet as they walked. "I don't know why you had to drag me outside." "Believe we covered that already?" He rolled his eyes. "Well, just so we're clear, there's no such thing as spending too much time in my lab, and there's no fresh air anywhere on Kamoya." He glanced at the glades and canals along this portion of road and wrinkled his nose in disgust. "Are you going to complain all the way back, too?" Because he'd done the same on the way to the shipyard, and despite her fondness for the tall, gangly young man, with his chaotic hair, ridiculous IQ, and amusing personality, Ryan had her limits. And those limits had been sorely tested the last few months. Nico glanced over his shoulder at the shipyard they'd left a few minutes earlier. Pieced together over the years, it appeared to be a random jumble of scaffolding, cranes, docking stations, repair berths, and large outbuildings.
Drained you dry, huh?
Ace of Spades, her ship, her workhorse, her home, her passage to the stars, had just passed her flight test. She was back there in berth, ready to fly. 5 weeks just to get parts to repair a fried FTL drive, and another 4 for the techs to install it to make sure Ace was spaceworthy. Yeah, kid. Drained me dry. 3 entire bank accounts had been wiped clean. Parts and labor. And the bribes necessary to ensure that Ace's repairs stayed off the books, and, more importantly, off local chatter, had erased half of her life savings. One more blow like that, and she'd be out of business. Not to mention the fact that her financials wouldn't stay off the radar for much longer. Have no one to blame but me, she said under her breath.
Don't be too hard on yourself, Cap, or on Little Bit. He didn't mean to fry the FTL. Our technology couldn't keep up.
Something he could easily have calculated.
Sure, had he not been fragmented, Nico reminded her.
Ryan let out a soft snort. They'd had this argument too many times to count in the last several weeks. Nico worshipped the AI, and ever since they'd fled Venezia and arrived on Kamoya, the kid had holed up in his corner lab with a colloquially named Little Bit, quizzing the thing, learning to make sense of LB's fragmented leaps from clarity to nonsense, working out answers to old questions and forming new ones.
Les thinks you're becoming obsessed.
She checked the time again.
Les likes her labels.
He waved at another insect.
If you could only see what I see. We think we're so advanced, but the Forerunners were a gazillion years ahead of us. Our advances are child's play in comparison. They could build entire planets, Cap. We saw it for ourselves. Well, the aftermath, but still. Planets! And now we have this gateway to the past in our possession. We have LB. Not the military, not intelligence, not the science or tech sector. We do.
He shoved his hands in his pockets and turned to walk backwards so he could face her.
Just imagine what we could learn. All knowledge and tech that's been withheld from us in the name of defense. All the things we can create and understand and share with the little guys. All the places LB can point us to, the things we can uncover about the past.
Ryan lifted a brow. That's a lovely little speech. He turned around and fell in step beside her.
Okay, fine. I might be a little obsessed, but who wouldn't be?
Me, she wanted to say. Ryan had taken the ancient, fragmented AI on board her ship, where it immediately began evaluating Ace's systems. But it had been her decision to allow it in, to modify and change. She'd sat there on the bridge, watching the pod carrying Cade's body sail into a nearby dwarf star, and permitted the AI to reconfigure Ace's engines without thinking too deeply of the consequences. LB had created a streamlined slipspace portal that had gotten them from uncharted space back to Venezian orbit in record time. The jump ended up killing her drive and causing something he casually referred to as just a minor bobble in space-time reconciliation, whatever the hell that meant. It was a miracle they'd made it back to Venezia in one piece.
He's not all bad, you know. The tech we've been working on couldn't be built without him, and he did save our asses from Kip.
LB's discovery of their engineer's treachery had bought them enough time to settle Ramshalva in the hospital and call in a favor to get a tow out of town and straight to Kamoya. It hadn't taken long, though, for Kip's true employer, the Office of Naval Intelligence, to come calling. A week later, an Agent Han began sending Ryan private messages through trade forums and chatter, asking for information on her debris field, all of which she ignored. Ryan had an entire galaxy in which to hide. Oni wouldn't find her until she began accessing her accounts. Today was that day, and Ryan intended to be long gone before the spooks could arrive. She had plans. Plans to avenge Cade's death, plans to recoup their losses, and plans to go back to the debris field to look for her father and his missing ship. She checked the time again. One more thing to do, and then they'd be gone.
Heads up, guys,
Les's voice finally buzzed through comms. Can't believe I'm saying this, but he's here. I got eyes on Geklar.
Ryan had been expecting the news, but hearing it and knowing the alien bastard who'd murdered one of their crew was nearby stalled her in her tracks. Fresh grief rushed in, causing a sharp stab of pain through her chest. 10 weeks was hardly enough time to mourn the loss of the man she'd known and loved in one way or another for a decade. Not nearly enough time. Nico stared at her with wide, emotional eyes, and for a moment she didn't know what to say. His grief was just as legitimate as hers. Cade having been a mentor and a stable father figure where none had ever been before. And while she wanted to comfort him, now was not the time. Instead, she grabbed his shoulders and gave them a good squeeze. "Put it in a box, kid," she said softly. "Remember the plan?" He nodded quickly, attempting to regroup.
"Destroy the roach."
"That's right. His honor, his dignity, his standing, his credits, his ship. We're taking it all, everything, until he's left with nothing but those dog tags on his shoulder. And when it's all gone, when we've broken him, we'll take those too, and send him straight to hell where he belongs." She released his shoulders, let out a deep sigh to regroup as well, and ruffled his hair. "You good?" His wrecked smile nearly did her in.
"Yep, I'm good."
He wasn't good. None of them were. If that were the case, they'd be organizing their next salvage op instead of putting their lives on the line in the name of vengeance.
"He just landed over in Westglades," Lessa said, clearing her throat and sounding a little emotional, too. As Kamoyan airfields went, it was the perfect spot for the Sangheili. Farthest from the city center, on a bit of dry ground and surrounded on three sides by murky mudflats and natural clearings.
"Looks like Nora's intel was right again," Nico said. "Elid's auction was enough to draw him in."
One of the preeminent dealers of salvaged goods and military surplus along the Via Casalina, and a trusted business ally, Venezia-based Norfell, had contacted Ryan a few days prior with news that Geklar would be attending a private auction held on Kamoya by the Eon Het trader known only as Elid. News that was both troubling and surprising, because unlike Nor, who refused to sell weapons of mass destruction, Elid didn't have such limitations. And according to Nor, not only was Gek attending, but he'd taken specific steps to procure an invitation, which raised more than a few eyebrows. Lar was a Sangheili commander. He didn't attend auctions. He and his cronies took what they wanted, killed for what they wanted. They scoured the galaxy from military surplus to rebuild the Covenant into its former glory. Playing by Elid's rules put the Sangheili in a rare and vulnerable position, one which Ryan would, naturally, use to her advantage. But he had to know the risk he was taking. He'd left the debris field, a veritable gold mine of Forerunner salvage, to come here. What else could he possibly want or need?
"You really think he'll fall in line and play by auction rules?" Lessa asked. "I mean, that's not really his M.O.
"No, but he's outmatched here and he knows it." "I'd like to see him try something," Nico said. "Kamoya has, what, 60 or 70 ships with working cannons?"
And used together, they could create a formidable anti-aircraft barrage, potentially blasting anything out of the sky. Not to mention that, during the auction, house rules severely handicapped anyone in attendance.
"Roger that, little brother," Les agreed. "I'll get a few more images and then meet you guys back at the warehouse."
"We're about 15 minutes out," Ryan said,
picking up the pace as they entered the eastern edge of the city. As they navigated through the narrow dirt streets and canal bridges, through one vast cargo hold after another, Ryan barely saw or heard the sights and sounds and people. Geklar's image loomed large in her mind. There hadn't been a day in the last 10 weeks that she hadn't seen him in her thoughts and dreams, standing over Cade's body, a triumphant leer on his Saurian face. The only bit of solace Ryan had was the wound she'd given him with her M6. She'd been trying to kill, not maim. The bullet had sliced across the left side of his face, destroying his eye and leaving a deep, jagged mark that could never be hidden. A smear on his precious honor. A wound given to him not in glorious battle against a worthy foe, but by an unclean human female. While she took immense pleasure from that,
She wouldn't be satisfied until the hinge head was utterly broken. At the northwestern edge of the city sat the Loren, a large transport barge 327 meters in length and 38 meters wide. Its original storage compartments and separate entries made perfect warehouses to rent to the good citizens and patrons of Kamoya. A small airfield had been cleared nearby, which made the unloading and transporting of goods and storage a breeze. As Ryan punched in the entry code to her compartment, an old, beat-up mongoose ATV, caked in dirt and mud, pulled up and parked next to her. Lessa shoved her dirty goggles to the top of her unruly blonde curls and tugged a dusty handkerchief from the bottom half of her face. She cut the ignition and hopped off the quad, handing Ryan a data pad as the warehouse door slid open. "Gek's still using that atrocious old war freighter." The data pad contained recon images Lessa had just taken. "Any support vessels?" Ryan asked. "How many crew?" "I counted 7 Sankhili plus him. No other ground support I could see. Nico will have to take a peek inside Calabetti's orbital surveillance to see if he brought any friends." After they filed inside, Nico entered the code to lock the door behind them and then tossed Lessa a towel from one of the workbenches. "Does Ram know?" he asked. Lessa wiped the grime from her face. "If he had his comms on, I don't know." Ryan set the data pad on the countertop. "I'll go talk to him." "He was on the roof when I left," Lessa said. Ryan headed for the stairs built into the far side bulkhead wall. Her boots echoed on the metal rungs as she climbed the 2 flights and then ducked through the open hatch, stepping out onto the roof of the warehouse. Ram Shalva sat in his usual spot, both legs dangling over the edge, watching the ships coming and going across the many airfields positioned around Kamoya, a bottle of local marsh cane whiskey at his side. She wondered if he even saw what was before him, or if he was wandering around in circles again, inside his own head. Ryan had lost 2 crew members, and in their place was Ram Shalva, a damn fine jack-of-all-trades and former captain of his own salvage ship. A wounded, pissed-off Kamoyan, who had shown up in his homeworld a few days ago, asking around about Ryan and the Ace of Spades. She'd watched him for a day before approaching him at a bar on the upper deck of the erstwhile. Ryan had pulled up a stool next to a very surprised Ram, ordered a drink, and done a little asking of her own. They ended up talking for hours.
"I was the last of my crew. Gek was done with me. I knew I wasn't leaving Laconia alive. Without you picking me up, I never would have made it."
Ram lifted his whiskey glass in salute, and they drank.
"I'm sorry about Cade," he said. "He was a stand-up guy."
They toasted Cade and drank again.
"I'm sorry about your crew," she said. Another toast, another drink.
They toasted a lot of things that night, and Ryan learned way more than she'd ever wanted to know about what it was like to be the prisoner of a hinge head. The things Geklar and his soldiers had done to Ram and his crew were unspeakable, and she was surprised he'd lasted as long as he had. He was right. If they hadn't rescued him when they did, putting him in a medically cryo-induced state to halt the advance of his injuries until they returned to Venezia, Ram would have died.
"So what now?" she asked him, assuming he would hang up his salvager hat.
"Well, I'm out of ship. My crew is gone."
They toasted his crew again.
"And I'm back to square one."
After a moment of thought, he asked,
"What would you do if you had the choice?"
She didn't want to think about what he'd endured and the loss of his people. A longtime crew was like family, and he'd lost them all. Would she throw in the towel? Start a new life with boots on the ground, leaving the stars behind? Out there was a world of hurt, a world of unknowns. Yet, despite her own losses, it still called to her, and she imagined it always would. She could no more leave behind the life she'd chosen than she could the Ace of Spades or her crew.
"Well, I suppose I'd find a new ship, start over."
He smiled, and they toasted again.
"To the scrap."
"To the stars."
And they drank.
"Let me crew with you for a while," he said unexpectedly. "I'm still healing, but I'm a good pilot and engineer. I know the job, and I can work any systems you got on that Blackbird of yours."
"What about being captain of your own ship?
I know you've got a stash of credits somewhere. We all do. He dipped his head in agreement. And I could go out and find a decent ship somewhere, hire a new crew, be back up there in a few weeks. But he twirled the clear liquid in his glass for a moment.
Between you and me, I'm not ready to call the shots just yet. I have a lot going on up here at the moment.
He pointed to his head.
And to be honest, I'm leery.
Of what?
Of too much time on the ground. The longer I'm down here, too much time passes and, well, I'm not sure I'll have the heart to get back in the game. Not after Laconia.
He shrugged.
Crewing with you will keep me in.
Without the pressures of being captain, she finished. He nodded. Ryan couldn't say she was surprised. After what had happened to Cade, she still wasn't sure she was ready herself. It was a hell of a lot of responsibility for one person to bear, even for a pro like Ramshalva. She gestured to where he pointed at his head.
And will that be a problem? No, that's on me. I'll deal with it. I'm good enough to fly, don't worry about that.
What could she say? She'd lost two of her crew, Kip the traitor and Cade the everything, and there was no replacing him. No one could. But the extra set of experienced hands, especially if they ran into trouble again, was an opportunity that didn't come around very often.
Tell you what, we'll give it a go. You can fill in as engineer on our next run, and then we'll see, all right?
Ram's mouth was tight as he nodded, staring at his glass for a long moment before meeting her gaze. He was a tough man, a longtime rival and good friend, and she hated seeing the suffering behind his grateful look. He lifted his glass and gave her a dry grin.
Here's to old rivals.
And friends. They clinked glasses and drank again. Ram glanced over his shoulder as Ryan approached. He was short and stocky, with a deep olive complexion and eyes so dark they nearly matched his black hair and beard. He wore his shoulder-length hair pulled back in a band and always had a thin hand-rolled cigarette tucked behind his ear or stashed in his front pocket. His hands and arms were covered in faded constellation tattoos. She joined him, taking a seat on the edge. He didn't wait for her to spell it out.
I heard, was all he said.
You gonna be okay?
What choice do I have?
Ryan hesitated. I need to be sure you'll stay frosty and stick to the plan. He watched a shuttle take off in the distance.
Death is too easy for the things that bastard has done. Don't worry about me. I'm with you. We're going to take everything from him, make him miserable, alone, dishonored.
He studied her for a hard second, before a slow smile split through the beard to reveal white teeth.
And then we'll kill him.
At that point, they might not have to. In a culture based on military prowess and loyalty to master and clan, honor was the foundation upon which the Sangheili carried their very existence. A true Sangheili warrior would choose death over dishonor any day.
How much time do we have? Ram asked.
Less than an hour until the auction.
You sure Elid will let you in, coming in at the last minute?
That's the thing about greed, she said, getting up. Makes folks predictable.
And while Ryan didn't prefer showing up uninvited, she really didn't have a choice, thanks to Kip and Oni. Once she sought out an official invite, Elid would run his standard financial check on her accounts, a prerequisite for entry. The credit inquiry, no matter how secret it was supposed to be, would light up Oni's advanced surveillance boards like a goddamn laser show. Better to do it all at the last second, before entering the auction, than to give Oni a head start on her location. Ryan regarded the man as he returned his attention to the night sky and lifted the bottle to his lips for another swallow.
Just be ready, she said.
He finished his drink and then tipped the bottle toward her to show that he heard loud and clear. Chapter 2 HRB Flintlock, Financial District, Kamoya, Sverdlovsk System. The Flintlock served as the center of Kamoya's West Side Financial District. In its former life, it had been part of a fleet of bank-owned securities transit vessels, now meticulously upgraded with the latest surveillance technology and armed to the teeth. It made the perfect place for Kamoya's high-end black market, and an even better place for very private, very below-board auctions. Every vendor, browser, and buyer came armed. To frequent the market without protection was a mistake made only once. Even the credit runners, transporters, and messengers were packing. And Ryan always had a sneaking suspicion that the old marsh cane vendor near the stairs sported a few rifles under her table of sweets. Ryan leaned casually against the second-story railing of the old ship's cargo stairwell, chewing on a stick of sweet marsh cane and watching the crowd. Not that she needed the bird's-eye view. The three Sangili warriors marching into the market had little care for stealth or for anyone unfortunate enough to be in their path. They stood out, not because they were Sangili. There were enough mercenaries of that ilk around these days, but because of the way they cut through the mob, patrons either scrambling or knocked aside. Ryan tossed her cane stick into the trash and headed down the stairwell.
"He's here. Two guards with him."
"Sounds about right," Les said over comms. "I'm counting 5 hinge heads left on the ship. They're keeping it warm, Cap. He doesn't plan to be here long."
Ryan made it to the cargo bay's main floor and began easing her way into the Sangili's chaotic wake with unhurried steps. She wasn't worried about losing them. She knew exactly where they were headed.
"Little bit, is it there?" she asked, ducking beneath an awning and stepping over a spilled basket of salvaged motherboards.
"Is what there, Captain Forge?"
came the congenial voice of their adopted forerunner AI. Nico's whisper crackled through the comm speaker.
"The Luminary."
"Of course," LB said, remembering. "The Luminary is indeed on board the war freighter."
Ryan rolled her eyes and dodged a few persistent sellers. How many times had they gone over the plan?
"Where on the freighter?"
"Oh, yes, the bridge, Captain. The Luminary is on the bridge."
"Ram."
5 is no problem. They'll be out like a light in no time. We've got it covered on this end."
"As soon as you've got the Luminary, get to Ace and request launch codes. We're all paid up with the Yard Chiefs, so there shouldn't be any issues getting the go-ahead to burn. I'll be with you guys shortly."
"Roger that," Ram said. "We'll keep Ace running."
After a chorus of good lucks and be carefuls filled her calm, the earpiece grew silent as the sounds of market activity took over. As plans went, it was, as Cade would say, balls out. She could picture the tall, broad-shouldered ex-Marine saying it, dry smile, amused eyes, always having her back whether he agreed with her tactics or not. Love and grief and fear made people do dangerous things, and Ryan was no exception. Revenge had a hold over her and the crew, and they weren't going to back down until Geklar paid for all the lives he'd taken away. One way or another, the Sangili commander was about to have a very, very bad day, and it was just the beginning. Ryan edged away from the main market area and paused at the head of a long corridor, giving the Sangili time to find the large vault Elid had repurposed into his auction house. As she waited, she reached into her pocket, retrieved a pair of black gloves, and pulled them on. The right glove was a normal black mesh and synthetic material, but the left one, while made from the exact same material, sported a wafer-thin, malleable scanner sewn into the palm of the glove. With Little Bit's help, Nico had been able to turn his idea into a working prototype, a small device that recorded the residual light left on a datapad screen. A message, a look at finances, a picture. If it had recently been on the screen, the scanner could capture and store the light impression left behind. It had no communications or relay capabilities, so it would remain undetected and unaffected by Elid's jammers. Once reunited with the software Nico and LB had also created, they'd be able to download the scans and reconstruct the residual light of up to 2 or 3 consecutive images. Ryan was keen on using it to get a better idea of what Gek might be up to and how to make what remained of his life a living hell. As soon as a gleam of light illuminated the corridor, she knew the Sangili were inside the vault. She glanced at the time. 5 minutes to auction. It was now or never. Ryan straightened and headed down the corridor, keeping her thoughts focused and her courage up. Once she entered, she'd be in a frequency dead zone, with all communication-capable technology,
comm pads, data pads, translators, you name it, completely useless. The only tech allowed here was strictly controlled by Elad. By the time Ryan neared the vault door, she'd been swept by a number of security protocols, none of which were seen but were there nonetheless. Commissioned by the now-defunct Harris Romner Bank, the Flintlock had been created with the highest protection measures of its time, offering transport and storage of private and commercially owned valuables across the galaxy. When the ship was sold, Elud and his investors had purchased it, bringing it here to Kamoya and reshaping it into the perfect financial center. Two familiar Sangheili mercenaries armed to the teeth in a mishmash of Covenant War-era armament flanked the hallway, their rifles slung over muscled gray shoulders, clawed hands casually supporting the barrels. Their bare heads turned in unison as they stared down at her from their lofty height, regarding her with the same kind of irritation Nico had for Kamoya's gnats, their insect-like mandibles shuddering mildly in disgust. "Hey, fellas," Ryan said, knowing the casual greeting would add to their annoyance, before turning her attention to a small metal desk placed outside the enormous vault door. Behind the desk, Tom, a male Aeon Het, was regarding her with a high degree of disdain. While the Aeon Het appeared to be the most humanoid of the alien species, they were also one of the most unapproachable and misunderstood. Ryan had never seen a female, but the males were hairless with milky pale skin, deep-set eyes with sagging skin beneath, and drooping mouths lined with short, sharp teeth. Their foreheads were wrinkled in deep folds, but their cheek and brow bones were sharp and prominent, their heads sporting strange pox and markings. Each Aeon Het had two sets of slit-like nostrils cut into a wide nose, and a series of gills along the jawline. Tomna's attitude aside, the Aeon Het often projected a subservient air, but Ryan had found them to use that to their advantage. They were very cunning, excellent traders, and had a knack for acquiring the most unique artifacts. On the desk was a data pad and a neat row of sticky one-and-dones, small subgrade translation tech encircled by medical sticky tape. Peel the back off, place in front of an ear or over it, and voila, a neat little device that fit most alien species and peeled off easily when no longer needed. Cheap and disposable, they were an effective tool to hand out at large events or to give to folks in the outer colonies who couldn't afford even low-grade technology. Tomna handed one to Ryan. She removed the back and placed the coin-sized piece on the skin in front of her ear. Inside the vault, Elad would be employing an ambient translator, which covered the entire space, but out here in the hallway, where her own tech was jammed, these were necessary to communicate.
"Name?"
the Aeon Het asked, even though he knew exactly who she was.
"Ryan Forge, same as last time."
He ignored the sarcasm, checked his data pad, and then gave her a smirk.
"Sorry, Tomna does not see Ryan Forge on the list."
Maybe Tomna should inform Elad that Ryan Forge is out here in the hallway with curiosity and credits to burn. Lots and lots of credits. Or don't. But once Elad finds out Ryan Forge was here, Elad might always wonder if a higher price could have been achieved. So what's on the auction block today anyway? Tomna's nose wrinkled, and he let out a soft hiss to show his displeasure before accessing his data pad and typing in a quick message. A ding sounded a few seconds later.
"Fine. Tomna sees your credit was last checked 5 months ago. Must run another before entry."
"Of course." Due to Ace's repairs, she'd had to pool all of her and Ram's funds into one account in order to show her good status. Nerve spiking, she bit on her bottom lip, waiting. One more step to go, and then she'd be inside a locked vault with an elite Sangheili warrior who wanted her dead. The question of sanity wasn't lost on her, but then her grandfather always said self-preservation was a foreign concept to the Forge family.
"Ryan is cleared to enter,"
Tomna said, nodding to the guards, who stepped forward to receive her weapons. Once she'd handed over two loaded M6s, extra ammo, two knives, and a stun gun, the Sangheili swept her with a sensor. She peeled off the one-and-done and stuck it to Tomna's desk, much to his ire. Tomna stood, stepping past her to the entry pad mounted on the wall by the vault. Ryan continued to watch him, leaning over slightly to see, until he turned around and hissed at her again. A series of metal locks echoed inside the door before the thick barrier slid back. Ryan drew in a deep breath and went inside. Here we go. Chapter 3. UNSC Torocado, 400 kilometers above Gao, Cordoba system. Walter Hahn was just finishing up a quick meal at his desk when Turkish, the holographic avatar of the ship's smart AI, appeared over the small integrated projector in the desk surface unit.
Agent Tom.
The AI's hands were clasped behind his back, posture ramrod straight. He wore the uniform of an early 1900s-era field soldier from the Ottoman Empire, complete with handlebar mustache and proper accent.
Pardon the interruption.
Hahn wiped his mouth and refolded his napkin carefully. He always found it fascinating, the AIs he'd come across and the wide range of avatars they'd chosen to represent themselves. Was it indeed some lingering memory, some deep ancestral impression of the donor mind that went into shaping the AI's choice? Or was it completely a reflection of the new personality emerging and its need to set itself apart from its donor? He was confident this one's choice of avatar was the former.
Yes, Turk, he asked. My surveillance of Ryan Forge has resulted in an alert, specifically in her financial activities. It seems a coded financial check was run through a highly encrypted credit system about an hour ago. I was able to break this code and unravel the encryption.
Could you trace the location?
The check was run from Kamoya, a small moon orbiting the gas giant Vitellivna in the Sverdlovsk system. I've alerted Captain Kara, and we're already prepping a slipspace jump to the system. We should arrive within the hour.
As luck would have it, they were still in one of the systems along the Via Casalina trade route. The jump wouldn't take too long.
Thank you, Turk. Would you please have Kip Silas sent to my office?
Certainly, Agent Hahn. He has now been alerted.
Hahn watched the avatar disappear before relaxing back into his chair and letting the information sink in. While he was surprised Captain Forge had evaded detection this long, he'd always known she'd eventually turn up. Hahn had recruited Kip Silas to work undercover as an engineer on the Ace of Spades, Captain Forge's salvage ship. While it was Kip's job to monitor and report on any high-value discoveries and salvage, Forerunner artifacts were the real prize and the driving force behind Han's directive, and they'd found more than Hahn could ever have hoped for. And then it had all slipped through their fingers. When news of losing the location of the debris field and a bona fide Forerunner AI had reached the highest levels of the Office of Naval Intelligence, Hahn had finally gotten the notice of his superiors. Not quite the way he'd envisioned it, but at least he was on Hugo Barton's radar. And when he fixed things with Oni's head of Forerunner Research and Acquisitions, Barton was sure to see Hahn's potential. Barton had ordered the heavy prowler Torocado to retrieve Kip from Venezia and then pick up Hahn from his base on Gao. Once on board, they'd both been debriefed and new orders received. Due to Hahn's excellent track record across the Via Casalina as a counter-contraband agent specializing in Forerunner artifacts, adept at handling informants and acquiring salvaged Forerunner relics, he was given a second chance to secure the AI and the coordinates to the debris field. At all costs. A faint ding alerted him to a presence outside his office door. On his view screen, he could see Kip Silas standing in the corridor.
Enter, he said.
Kip stepped inside, dressed in the nondescript black Oni uniform worn by the rest of the crew. Its crisp tailoring was completely lost amid the unkempt hair, red eyes, and unshaved jaw of the lackluster recruit. Hahn let out a deep sigh. Kip would never be a true company man. His lingering moral compass and natural desire to see the good in people, like Ryan Forge and her crew, would be the man's downfall. Taking the ethical high ground and doing the right thing was a luxury Oni couldn't afford. Not when they were competing in the Forerunner arms race against a reforming covenant. The sooner Kip fully adopted Oni's views, the better. Chapter 4. Vault 29864C, HRB Flintlock, Financial District, Kamoya. Ryan scanned the familiar vault. Floor-to-ceiling storage units of varying sizes, each with its own security keypad, lined the walls. Tall, round tables had been arranged in the center of the vault, designed for bidders and their guests to stand at during bidding. The gathering was small this time around, which meant the item up for auction was something most in the black market business couldn't afford. Four parties stood in attendance. Gek Lar and his two guards. Two Jiril Hanai, mercenaries from the look of them. Four Kigyar pirates, and two humans, most likely of the anti-unified Earth government elk. The humans gave her a nod of species recognition, which she returned as the heavy vault door closed behind her. Each individual echo of the locks sent fresh adrenaline pumping into her body. The guests seemed to eye her, one by one. First the humans, then the bird-like Kigyar, then the enormous hairy brutes, and finally... what had she been thinking? Gek Lar turned his head in Ryan's direction, and she held her breath. And 3, 2, 1. His singular beady eye, seemingly too small and lost within that giant leathery gray head of his, snagged on her, and time froze. The scar over the other eye was deep and jagged and pale, adding to his already menacing appearance. Ryan had envisioned this moment so many times during the last 10 weeks, and wasn't surprised when a hot wave of emotion surged to the surface, burning through her chest and stinging her eyes. Regret rode right along with the rage and grief. For a decade, she and Cade had danced around each other, moving together, moving apart, too scared to commit, too afraid of getting hurt. And now it was too late. He was gone. And she was sick and tired of holding it all in. Her mouth twisted into a smirk. The utter lack of fear and respect was more than the Sankhili commander could bear. Rage shuddered through all 2.5 meters of his body, multiplying exponentially as his claws flexed and a deep growl rumbled through his throat. Before she could blink, he shoved his guards aside and barged past the brutes and the Kigyar, the humans darting out of the way before they were trampled. There was nowhere to run, but Ryan wouldn't have fled even if there were a way out. She lifted her chin. Hooked ya, you goddamn roach. His hand closed around her neck, the skin rough and cold, as he lifted her off the floor and held her at eye level.
Mistake, little vermin, coming here taunting me.
He squeezed slowly until her airway closed. His mandibles flexed as he hissed and leaned close with that blunt reptilian face, watching her die, enjoying the time it took. Her heart hammered. Panic raced through her system. Remember why you're here. Trust the house. Where the hell was the house? Ryan slapped at Lar's cold, scaly shoulder, then moved lower, her left hand gripping the data screen on his bracer. The attendees simply watched. No one was going to stop the Sankhili. In reality, no one cared. The brutes were enjoying the show. The jackals squawked. And the humans regarded the entire affair sadly, as though she were already lying dead on the floor. Black dots floated in her vision. Trust the house. And then, finally, salvation. The telltale whine of lasers priming. She'd never loved a sound more. Chaotic shafts of red beamed over them, coalescing in fine points on Gek's forehead and throat. His grip eased a fraction.
Come now, Commander Lar.
A raspy voice filled the quiet that had quickly descended. The Onhet, Elod, stood behind Gek's shoulder, hands tucked behind his back.
Elod understands this way of doing business is new to the Commander, but Elod must insist rules be followed. Kill later if necessary, but not here. Unless Gek Lar himself is willing to die in order to kill this female.
The brutes chuckled deeply. A human female wasn't worth the sacrifice. Ryan slapped at Gek's hand and kicked wildly. House rules be damned at this point. She was about to pass out.
Elod has given Commander a chance, the Onhet continued. Don't ruin it.
Gek held Ryan's gaze for a drawn-out moment.
Once my business here is complete, I will end you, he promised.
but she barely heard the translated threat or cared, because his claws snapped open and she dropped to the floor. Blessed air flowed into her lungs, each desperate breath filled with pain as she landed hard, her legs giving out. But she'd made it. Unbelievably, she'd made it. Laughter tore through her throat like glass. The room spun, and her stomach clenched into a hard, sour knot. The commander marched back across the room, muttering about taking orders from a species that had once been the Covenant's slave labor. "How that must chafe," Ryan thought starkly, rubbing her sore throat. The fact that he was adhering to Elid's rules meant he intended to win whatever was up for sale. He wouldn't have come otherwise, and winning meant that Ryan walked free, while Gek had to stay behind and pony up the cost. By the time he was released from the vault, she'd be gone, with his luminary. And with new information from his bracer, thanks to Nico's glove device, it was the perfect setup. Ryan shoved a dark strand of hair out of her eye and looked up at Elid. The light in the vault cast a gray, sickly pall over his milky skin. He was nearly identical to Tomna, though the markings on his bald head were slightly different, and his gills and jagged teeth were a bit longer, suggesting a more advanced age. He wore a tunic of dark gray weave and a bemused expression on his face.
"Credits to burn, Elid hears."
Then he walked away to begin the auction. For a moment, Ryan stayed on the floor, waiting for her vertigo to subside and the strength to return to her limbs. But as soon as a metal cart was rolled into the room, she pushed to her feet. The cart held a viewscreen and a small metal box. Elid moved to its side with a remote in his hand.
"Inside this coded container are the access codes to a heavy excavator, formerly in service to the Covenant. Some of you call it a harvester."
On the viewscreen, an image appeared of an enormous six-legged excavator.
"As all can see from the timestamp, this is a real-time uplink."
The camera panned around the harvester.
"Elid does not have to express the power of such an item, nor the value of one with its original Sabeo Agola colony, and one that has a working plasma drill."
The enormity of what was being offered sank in. The Kig-Yar began cackling excitedly as the humans whispered to themselves, and the brutes looked eager to use the damn thing to shed as much blood as possible.
"The first such item to come onto market," Elid continued, "might very well be the last. Shall we begin the bidding?" "You claim the drill works. Show me,"
Gek demanded. Elid gave him a serene nod, then spoke into a comm.
"Activate the drill."
A few seconds passed before the screen flashed bright, fading to reveal an intense yellow beam of superheated plasma shooting from the mouth of the excavator, melting a hole into the nearby rock. An opening bid of 20 million credits from the Kig-Yar began the auction. Ryan lifted her hand, having no intention of buying. 25. As the bid increased around her, the pieces fell into place. Though they were used in battle, the harvester's primary function was as an excavator. For the last 10 weeks, Gek and his crew had had the opportunity to poke around the debris field. He possessed the luminary, which allowed him to detect and track down other Forerunner artifacts. He must have found something very big hidden very deep within the debris, something he couldn't recover without the harvester and its drill. She glanced around the room. There wasn't a single buyer in attendance with good intentions for this thing. Not one. Any one of them could glass an entire city with that machine. With the bid now at 35 million in favor of Gek, the Kig-Yar were out, and so was Ryan.
"Do I hear 40?
Elid inquired.
40! 40 million!
40 million,
one of the brutes piped up. The other humans immediately bowed out, leaving the Jiril Hanai with the top bid. Elid gave the room a few more seconds before turning his attention to Gek.
"Bid rests at 40 million.
Gek didn't respond, and for one brief moment, Ryan thought things were not going to pan out as she'd thought.
"Very well, then. Going once at 40 million. Going twice. 50 million.
Gek announced in a deep, threatening tone, leveling a death stare at the brutes. Hell, was he trying to wage war? Tension filled the room. The rage coming off the brutes was palpable. Even Elad, with all his security protocols, looked a little paler than before. He swallowed and found his voice.
50 million to the Sangheili.
Dead silence,